Welcome to the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. Have you ever wondered how people succeed in real estate and what steps they took to get there? If so, this podcast is for you. Your hosts, Sayla and Eileen Prack, interview top experts in the real estate community to share with you their real estate journey and how they achieved massive success. Our goal is to provide you with valuable real estate resources and to help you apply it to your own real estate goal. Welcome to today's episode of the How Did They Do It Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Eileen Prack, and today we have a fantastic guest for you, Salvatore Buscemi, and he is the CEO and co-founding partner of Brahman Partners and CEO of D'Andrew Partners Capital Management. He has a diverse portfolio spanning across commercial real estate, credit, fine art, private credit facilities, special situations, and life sciences investments. He's also the author of three books on real estate investment, including Making the Yield, Hard Money Lending Uncovered, Raising Real Money, the Handbook for the Aspiring Real Estate Fund Manager, and Investing Legacy, How the 0.001% Invest in Real Estate. So Sal, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here. How are you doing today?
Eileen, it's a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you for having me.
So Sal, can you share a little bit more about your background and your focus?
Sure. Yeah, I was born and raised in New York, raised out in Eastern Long Island, lived in New York through college and then working on Wall Street. I thought I wanted to go to medical school. I do talk about this in my third book, but I actually passed out holding a fibula, in the cadaver room of Beth Israel North Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. So after some come to Jesus meetings and some reflections, I learned a hard lesson the good way, and that is that the power of your network supersedes anything you do in school. And what happened was is that after I graduated, Eileen, the gentleman who I was championing, I didn't really have the heart to tell him I didn't want to go to medical school, although he was the one that picked me off the floor with the smelling salts. And he said, don't worry about it. My brother just made partner at Goldman Sachs. I think you should talk to him. He wants to talk to you. And then the rest is history, and I got into real estate, you know, through that. At 29, I raised $30 million from a Park Avenue institutional money manager, which is kind of a big deal at the time. Most people solicit their friends and family and frat boys and, you know, sorority sisters for money. But, you know, I went straight the institutional route. And that was the last time we saw the distress in the market that we're seeing today with Bear Stearns, and it relates to us buying all of that. So we bought the kitchen sink, and then I lived out west for a while, and we did the same thing, buying hard money loans that were in default, and we bought pieces of them, and then we were able to bundle them together. And it was really a very interesting business plan that we put together. And the driver behind it was that we were seeing a lot of opportunity and distress, similar to what we're doing right now. And we're getting ready for that. And we've already been ready for that. And, you know, I can get into that. But for the most part, during 2014, I noticed I was getting outbid on assets by, you know, people who didn't have any real estate experience but had access to credit. And mostly they were doctors and dentists, and they were buying things that they were overpaying for. And this is before the pandemic. And at that point, I started pivoting with my partner, now partner, into things such as life sciences, direct private investments with some of the wealthiest families and some of the most storied companies.
So Sal, can you share a little bit more about the distressed properties or the stress, what we're seeing right now, distress in the market that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, the real estate market, and I think everybody learned this the hard way, but the people who got involved in real estate now or are facing problems, in 2008, they were going through the last time this happened, right? So you had a cycle that happened, and these people don't remember it. The real moral of the story here, when you pull back the layers of the onion, is what is really driving the market? And it's rates. And so, you know, the economy is basically dependent upon rate movement in order to provide the liquidity in order for things to happen. And when rates are too low, animal spirits get away of each other. And you start to see people overbidding on things only because the credit's available there. And now we're seeing opportunities because the credit's not there, or the bank debt's not there. So the people who know how to raise private debt, private equity, like us, are the ones who are going to succeed. Because if you're waiting for a bank, well, those things wouldn't be so cheap in the first place if there was money available to buy it. And that really doesn't affect the assets too much, with the exception of office that we're seeing today, mostly a lot of office. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's not something we might get back into. We're actually looking at a New York City office building right now to co-invest into, but we're getting it at a good basis. It's not distressed, but it's not fully vacant, so not fully occupied, rather.
the current market right now, how does that impact the strategies and how you're looking at real estate and investing investing into, you know, different types of assets?
Well, the types of assets we invest into are mostly industrial, some offices, like I said before, but mostly industrial. And we like that because our families that we invest on behalf of are already rich. They're not looking to get rich. They're not looking to go from a Class C to Class B conversion. So with that said, we only target Class A assets that we invest into, number one. Number two is, you know, if I had that put together, we're really, even if it was like a multifamily in a very nice city like New York, for example, where, you know, vacancies are almost at zero right now for that stuff, we would want a Class A building. And we would qualify that because we're equity investors, right? We're not buying, we're not operators, we're not landlords. We're just equity investors. And with that, that allows us the ability to choose more opportunities where we have what I like, GPs that have experience. They've been through at least two cycles. They have audited financials, and they also have a meaningful co-investment, you know, a meaningful sponsorship co-investment. And that's exactly what we're looking for here with that. The second thing is that it has to be in a good market, not tertiary market, because that's really, as we say in the business, Eileen, the money always has a voice.
And what about the future of the market right now? Are you still looking for opportunities? Are you still optimistic about real estate? Or are you moving a lot of your investments into other types of assets outside of real estate?
No, we're getting back into real estate right now, because now's the time to be doing this. We are looking very hard. And I just came off of a site visit of a 500,000 square foot Class A to Class A industrial facility redo value added. And that's on the port of Tampa. So it's very, you know, it's a, the location is just absolutely amazing. You know, first rule of real estate is location, location, location. The second rule is always be raising capital. And so, you know, we've already begun on that, talking to some of our investors about that property and what their thoughts are, socializing it before we do a, you know, big launch and follow through with our formula with how we do these things and interacting with our families.
And so when you're raising capital also, and you're talking to the investors, is there a certain sentiment around the types of assets and the market and what it's going to look like, you know, later in this year?
Really, what we do when we talk to the investors, they all agree that they want top quality assets with best in class GPs. And what that looks like, they don't, you know, it's sort of like the first layer, right? Like, you're not going to look at a car, for example, if it doesn't have four doors, if you need a four door car. This is the way they look at it. They're not looking at value added deals.
So the investors that you're working with, they're primarily family offices.
Correct. Yes.
So for you, what is constituted as a family office?
Anyone that has or a family of $100 million or more in investable assets.
And then so also outside of the real estate, what else are you looking at?
We do a lot of earlier stage life sciences. We just actually championed an exit today on LinkedIn. We invested in a company alongside a very prominent Japanese family into a company called Sing Life. And they were bought out by their majority shareholder, Sumitomo Life, in an all cash deal. So we're all happy about that. And that's closing this quarter. And that's going to be putting money into the industrial deal that I was telling you about. We also like preclinical life sciences. We like technology. We love AI Scout. We're getting back into that right now. And we also love other things such as AI. And we invested in a company called AI Scout that we thought was very impressive. And another burgeoning company too, which follows the two rules that I have, is Thrive Bioscience. Thrive Bioscience is started by a founder who has built this company to be his 18th exit, and if he is successful, his 8th unicorn, Eileen.
Wow, that is crazy. That is amazing. But when you're looking at these, all these different types of investments, because, you know, you're working with large family offices, you're looking at larger deals and investment opportunities, what are some of the things that you also look at in terms of vetting and making sure that these investment vehicles are going to perform, or you're going to mitigate as much of the risks as possible?
That's a very good question. One of the things I'll tell you is that I have two rules when it comes to venture before we go any deeper. And I think Shark Tank's done this country like a huge disservice by making it look like any idea somebody with like an adjustable belt can, you know, have a multi-million dollar company or something else. There has been successes from that, but we don't invest in consumer discretionaries for the most part. So anything you see on Shark Tank is not for us. Anything that can be knocked off by a kid or someone overseas is not something for us. What we do look at is the founder, right? We bet on the jockeys, not the horses. And for us, that founder must have had a couple exits under his belt. These are not just, he's founded a lot of companies that went nowhere. We want to make sure that he's actually brought these deals across the 1 yard line to an exit, whether that's through an IPO or a acquisition, for example. The second thing that we like to look at is the capitalization table or who the investors are. And my rule is the cap table is the soul of the asset, Eileen. And if you have a bunch of $25,000, $50,000 chancers, that's really not anything that's really sustainable for the growth of the company. Nobody really wants to do that. So we want them to be led by, and this is rule number two, in-kind families. So the example of Thrive, you have very prominent families who are technology and bioscience families who, you know, I would mention like the Louders and some other people who have invested into this. We have a lot of money into it as well. But we feel very comfortable because the cap table is the soul of the asset. And that really is, you know, when people write the check, that is conviction in the deal. And it allows us to network with those families too. So we can compare notes saying, well, we invested or we're thinking of investing. What did you like about this? What did you like about that? And just comparing notes.
And then in addition to the track record of the founders and the people on the team as well, do you do deep dives on their background as well and them as people?
Yeah, we do. I look at it like a jealous ex-spouse. and we socialize it, right? It's like you're asking these investors who are writing seven-figure checks into these deals, like, all right, no, I went to college with him, he's a good guy, or no, I think, you know, or he wasn't a good guy, or, you know, he had a bad reputation, but he's changed, or, you know, he's had some failures here, or that company didn't work out quite the way he said it would, or, you know, and things like that. So you get the tea, you know, and that's part of the diligence that nobody really likes to think about. They like to look at numbers and think that they're smart and, you know, they're doing it, but there's a lot more behind the scenes. And that's the character. As I said, we bet on the jockeys, not the horses.
So what do you think that makes the 0.001% who are investing these types of deals, like what makes them so successful and stands out from, you know, all the other people amongst their peers?
I mean, you know, you'd have to ask the people who, you know, invested early on in Facebook or in Amazon.com, right? And I think what they looked at is that there was other smart investors. I mean, first of all, you have to understand the idea, right? And a lot of people don't understand the idea. Like if you were to look at SpaceX, you know, years ago, maybe 10 years ago, you'd think that, you know, Elon Musk was doing needle drugs. However, that's not the case anymore. And he's ready to spin out probably one of his most profitable companies in America, which is called Starlink. So it comes up to the value that these families can provide. And what I like to see, and I said before, in-kind families is, if it's a biotech company and a large biotech or life sciences family office gets, or a pharmaceutical family gets into it and leads the investment or just even gets into it, then that shows that there's a lot of conviction there. That to them means that they can do a lot more than just write a check. They can actually offer strategic relationships, introductions, you know, hop the queue to get to the front of head of business, you know, head of research and development to pitch your idea because, you know, this big investor knows this guy and is able to do that. So it's really the networking that's the most important here, but nobody's ever going to get up this high unless they see other people writing a check first. And when you start to see smart people who are like you, you know, birds of a feather, then you start to get more motivated and take a closer look at it, even if this industry is outside of your core expertise, like biotech.
You mentioned in-kind families. Can you share a little bit more about what that entails?
That's a very good question. So let's just say that you were, you're investing into life science company, and you'd want to make sure that it was a life science company that was, you know, a life science family, someone like that with a background who's had an exit or is a director or something. Maybe it could be, you know, maybe a big executive leading it from another company because they're looking to see that and they believe in it. That's in kind, right? They come technology to technology. What you don't want to see is a real estate family leading a technology company because they don't really have the skill set to do it. To them, it might be just discretionary and they just want to, you know, they want to be the first one on the cap table maybe, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have the expertise to do that. So that's what I mean by in-kind panels.
Got it. And because you're working with large amounts of capital also, and these deals are very large as well, what is that relationship building looking like when you're working with these different types of families?
It's like courting a significant other for marriage. Because after all, it is marriage. It's a relational business, and you have to build the relationships. And as they told us at Goldman Sachs, you know, focus on being long-term greedy. People today, and I think it's mostly a result of crypto and NFTs, but people got very, very transactional and impersonal. And when you're dealing with these people, they don't want to deal with someone impersonal. They want to be able to grow their networks and to be able to build themselves as well, both socially, economically, even their attractiveness, right? Who they know. That's why people buy, that wealthy families buy football teams, right? That's, you know, for their friends can say behind their back, I know the guy that owns, you know, this team or that skyscraper. So that's, you know, what it is. We're always coveraging them. You know, we're always on top of them. We help them out with things. You know, we explain it. There's a lot of handholding. There's a lot of education. Just because people have a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean they know everything about everything, right? And so I think, you know, once you explain things to a way where they can feel comfortable and you're part teacher and educator, that's how you build a lot of respect over the time.
Yeah, like you mentioned earlier, some of these families are only focused on the real estate portion, but they're not so focused on the tech side of things. And so being able to come across and teaching and explaining, you know, that side of the business of things for them would definitely help and go a long way, because they might not be an expertise in everything.
Correct. Yeah, I mentioned that in my book too.
So Sal, for you, what are you focused on next?
Right now, there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to really make a legacy in real estate. So we're being very surgical about how we're looking at these opportunities. We're being very careful with the people who we work with, of course. And that's, you know, part of it. And we also have a couple of exits coming up, and we're also just championing our companies. We don't invest in 100 companies a year. I think we invested in 4 last year. But we made, you know, those were multi-million dollar investments in each one of them. We're very interested in SpaceX. We're finishing that up, you know, getting that out of the way. And I think there might be some other things as it relates to some of the other companies, but maybe Neuralink too as well, right? A lot of the families want to get involved in these companies because they've already so far ahead. They want to be, you know, in front of the next Tesla, the next SpaceX, or, you know, the next Starlink, or, you know, what have you. We also have made an investment in a company called Stripe, which I really like. And if you're an entrepreneur, you use Stripe. Stripe has a tremendous amount of market share. They have 90%. I mean, they approached this year in 12 years for the first time to $1 trillion in processed payments. It took PayPal 22 years to get to that point. So there's a lot of it. There's a lot of things moving here. Things are moving faster. And there's a lot of money moving to the States. So there's a lot of opportunities to invest in these things. And when they go public, you know, you have a lot of outside money that's just pouring in because the United States is still a safe place for people to invest.
And in your book, Sal, how the 0.001% invest in real estate, what is the top 2-3 things that set them apart?
Set them as far as what they're investing into?
Yes.
Sometimes they don't use leverage. So you're familiar with the fashion brand Zara. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you might be surprised, but the owner of Zara, Amancio Ortega, he purchases, and we use him as a model, Class A real estate in Tier 1 cities for cash. Now, we're not buying for cash. We're, you know, investing, you know, at a GPLP level. But that's what he's doing. He has operating companies that throw off so much money that they have to invest in real estate. And so they always go for the world class, what we call statement assets or Class A real estate. And if you were to look on, you know, LinkedIn or Google, you'll see opportunities to read about him and, you know, the, you know, how he's bought the BBC building in Dublin, Ireland. And, you know, he bought a logistics and cold storage center here in Florida, things that make a lot of sense, but, you know, things that have a much more degree of stability than, say, a Class C multifamily investment where your tenants are probably going to be poorer than you.
How do they protect themselves from downturns or changes in the market?
They don't use a lot of leverage. That's it.
That's pretty straightforward.
That's it. I was at that question actually last week, and I'm like, oh, all right, might as well tell her the same one. All right.
So, Sal, how has real estate investing impacted your life?
It's allowed me, you know, real estate is a gateway to a lot of people investing in other things. And if you're able to persuade and influence those people to invest in things that might have a higher impact, but, you know, profitability and outsourced returns are one thing, but to give them bragging rights, I think that is something that I think has changed my life, is the ability to bring people the crossover to the riskier side of venture that we were talking about before, into companies headed by world-class founders that they might not have been able to invest into on their own because they didn't have the network. They were real estate people. But, you know, one of the things I noticed, and for anyone who's raising capital out there, is that every real estate family worth their salt has an exposure to life sciences, and that's through the philanthropy that they support. Now, they don't really like their philanthropies or who they give money to because it's very expensive and they don't know where the money goes. But if you're able to raise money from them to make a direct investment into your company and show them where the money goes, and about 100 cents on the dollar goes towards your company, then you're going to win a lot of friends that way. And so that's one of the secrets of why we were able to pivot to life sciences and be successful in that.
And what is the one thing you know now about real estate that you wish you knew when you first started?
It's the second rule of real estate. And everybody's wishing they knew this right now, but I learned it very, very early on. Always be raising capital. Even if you don't have a deal, just talk and network with people.
Is it easier now to raise capital than it was, or is it more challenging now in the market?
Most people, it's a very interesting question that you asked. From what I've heard, and we've not really gone hardcore, people are looking for deals, and everybody knows that wealth is made in real estate, and there's downturns in real estate. So it's easier to sell right now because it looks like everything's on a distress or a bargain level. So it's easier to get the interest for them to invest. So if you lead with that, then you're going to be successful, right? A lot of smart investors or people who think they were smart did not get into real estate because they thought the prices were too high. They thought the assumptions were too high. Look, and lo and behold, inflation's eating away at everybody's income. And, you know, Class C, Class B, tenants are struggling financially. So everybody knows that everything has a price and a basis. And even that office that I was talking about in New York near Wall Street has a basis on it, right? So, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, what's that basis and how much are you going to pay to cover your holding costs for when things turn around?
And what is the one thing that sets successful people apart in real estate investing?
Networking and salesmanship. You are a salesman first. You should spend 50% of your time talking to new investors or current investors. You should be active on social media, and you should be writing letters. You should follow me on LinkedIn, actually, because I write blog posts on this. But you should be very, very interactive, because today attention is valuable. It's more valuable, actually, Eileen, than oil. And if you think about anyone who's trying to get a podcast up and running, a book or anything, it was a lot easier when there wasn't a lot of channels. Today, everybody's bombarding you with messaging, and attention is the most precious resource there is out there.
And so, Sal, how can our listeners find out more about you?
They can follow us by joining my multifamily offices newsletter. They go to brahminpartners.com, B-R-A-H-M-I-N, partners.com. Or they can get a copy of my book by going to investinglegacy.com/book. investinglegacy.com/book, and I'll send you an autographed copy of it. It is available there on Audible as well, so that's good. That would be great. And follow me on LinkedIn, Salvatore Bashemi, Brahmin awesome. Partners.
Awesome. Sal, thank you so much for your time today. Definitely appreciate everything you shared.
Eileen, I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to our podcast today, brought to you by Bonavest Capital. We would really appreciate it if you can go to iTunes right now and leave a rating and written review. Also, please don't forget to subscribe so you can always get the latest episodes. You can also connect with us on Facebook, How Did They Do It Real Estate. We'd love to hear your feedback and any topics that you're interested in for future episodes. If you're anything like Zayla and me and believe that real estate investing is a great way to create passive income and build long-term wealth, check out our free apartment syndication due diligence checklist for passive investors at bonavestcapital.com/checklist.
Sayla and I created this checklist for ourselves as we evaluated different multifamily syndication opportunities as a passive investor. So we would love to share it with you so you can use it as a resource as well. Download your free copy today at bonavestcapital.com/checklist. Lastly, to learn more about us, you can go to bonavestcapital.com and fill out the contact us page so you can speak to us directly. Nothing on the show should be considered as specific personal advice. Please consult your legal, tax, and real estate professionals for individualized advice.